Landmark Pacific is known for their outstanding steel buildings and general contracting. But did you know that they're also a fantastic choice to maintain your existing building? When new construction isn't an option, maintaining your existing pre-engineered steel building is absolutely imperative. Incorrect materials can greatly reduce the life of your metal roof. For metal re-roofs, repairs, or additions and remodels, call the experts at Landmark Pacific, 503-743-3256. That's 503-743-3256.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Well, it's good to be back. Although I guess we didn't actually go anywhere. It just sort of felt like we did, taking a week off from politics and doing a new Easter show. But we're back now, keeping an eye on big government. You know, there's an old saying, those who can, do. Those who can't, teach. But where do you go when you can't do or teach? Why? Into politics, of course. Into the hallowed halls of bureaucracy. It's not that people who work for government try to screw up. It's just inevitable. But I will say that they seem to mess things up with uncanny ability and precision. I've said before, speaking of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that some people are naturally stupid. Some people dedicate a lifetime to its pursuit. It's strange how many of the latter end up running government. I mean, you couldn't screw things up this much, this often, without really applying yourself. And perhaps nowhere is this more evident than Oregon's government. Okay, maybe California, but they're bigger, so they've got there first just out of sheer volume. In Oregon, Democrats, who hold a supermajority and can do anything they want, now there's a recipe for disaster, Democrats in large herds in charge of government, they've decided that because they make a rule, it will magically fix reality. You know, maybe they really believed Obama when he said he was going to stop the oceans from rising. But I digress. After a lifetime of pursuit, Democrats in Oregon think that the basic rules of economics no longer apply. Likewise, they think that if you leave piles of wood to dry in the hot summer sun and then let trees grow near it, that somehow it won't catch fire. Next, they'll pass a rule that says it's illegal for grass to grow anymore, except the kind you smoke. That way, no one ever has to mow their lawns again. Here in Oregon, they recently passed rent control laws. Rent control doesn't work, but that doesn't stop Oregon Democrats because, like socialism, this time it will work. They also think it's better to let forests burn and rot and become infested than do what you do when your lawn gets too tall. Cut it. They'd rather spend more than $500 million on fighting fires than make a couple billion by cutting timber. Like I said, for some, it's a lifetime pursuit. You have to admire them, though. At least they've found their calling. I'd like to welcome now Ethan Blevins. He's an attorney for Pacific Legal Foundation, which litigates nationwide to achieve court victories to enforce the Constitution's guarantee of individual liberty. We here on iSpy Radio keep an eye on big government, so they are definitely right up our alley. Ethan, it's great to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've known about and watched Pacific Legal Foundation for a while, but this is the first opportunity that we've taken to have somebody on from Pacific Legal to talk to directly. So talk to our audience, though, a little bit about Pacific Legal Foundation. Your website's About Us page says that you're a nonprofit legal organization that defends Americans' liberties when threatened by government overreach and abuse. We sue the government when it violates Americans' constitutional rights. So what kinds of cases specifically do you take on?
Well, sort of a variety. We're probably most well-known for our property rights work. So we do a lot of takings issues where the government has seized property or has overregulated your property so heavily that it effectively has taken your property and owes you just compensation. So we do a lot of property rights work. We do a lot of property rights related work in the environmental regulation area. So we've been very involved in, for example, Clean Water Act issues. We do a lot of free speech work, economic liberty, equality under the law, separation of powers. So it's sort of a variety of issues that all touch on what ultimately is an individual's right to pursue happiness uphold their rights to life, liberty, and property.
And do you do Second Amendment as well?
We have not done Second Amendment issues. It's just largely because a lot of other great groups are involved in that. So
sure.
We've all kind of settled into our niches.
Right.
We've done some issues that touch on gun rights, but not directly.
I see. And when you say you're suing the government, is that both state and fed, or is it just federal or just state?
It's sort of all levels of government, from counties to cities, all the way up to federal government. A lot of our environmental work is focused on federal regulation. A lot of our separation of powers work also is on the federal level. And then there's a lot of issues that are more local. So property rights, for example, is a lot to do with local regulation. So it kind of depends on the issue, but all levels of government we're involved in.
Well, property rights, environmental, government overreach, I'm sure you don't do anything at all in Oregon.
We were involved in a few Oregon cases, as you might imagine. We had actually an occupational licensing issue with regulation of architects that went to the Oregon Supreme Court a little while ago. And yeah, I mean, there's much to do at every state, but I definitely think the West, any coastal state, gets a lot of our attention, I'll say.
Yes, yeah, I can imagine. So how does your organization choose its cases? Do people come to you? Do you find them? How does that work?
You know, it's a mixture. Mostly, you know, we kind of keep an ear to the ground and pay attention to what's coming down the pipeline and look for issues that interest us. And then we'll often reach out and look for individuals who are affected by a law that concerns us. And we do have public inquiries come in, and somebody will say, hey, I'm concerned about how, you know, this historic landmark designation is affecting my property or things like that. But typically, we take cases that we've looked for and found. Sometimes we take them on appeal where there's already a trial court decision, and sometimes we take them from the ground up where there's a law that's recently been passed by, for example, the city of Seattle that we're concerned about. We'll reach out to our allies to find people who are affected by it and challenge it that way.
Now, it sounds like you guys do a lot of work with individual people. Do you also do work with organizations?
Yes, we have. You're right, though, that I think most of our cases were representing individuals who are affected by government regulation, but we've also represented farm bureaus and other organizations that in turn represent those individuals. And so it depends on the issue. In Seattle, we're representing, for example, the Rental Housing Association of Washington and some litigation. But typically, you know, I think part of it is that the story of the individuals is typically a little more powerful and sympathetic. But also, we're focused on individual liberty. And so we like to be able to represent the individual against the government.
Well, with a supermajority here in Oregon, there is certainly plenty of room for government overreach. One of the latest is the rent control that they just passed here in the legislation. So we'd like to talk to you about that after this break. Coming up, we'll be talking more with Ethan Blevins. He's an attorney for Pacific Legal Foundation. Their website is pacificlegal.org. And Mac, this is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to Ethan Blevin. He's an attorney for Pacific Legal Foundation. He is out of their Salt Lake City office, but does a lot of work here in the Pacific Northwest. Their website is pacificlegal.org, and Pacific Legal sues the government for government overreach and abuse of power. How can you not like a group like that? And we should have mentioned in the first segment there that you guys are donor-supported. And so if people want to get involved on the funding of things, they may not necessarily need you for legal reasons, but if they want to help support you, how would they do that? Simply through the website?
Yes, it's pretty straightforward. So pacificlegal.org will take anyone who's interested to pay to our website that'll explain all the work we do and how to support our efforts.
I see. So in your article on Fox News, beware the false promise of rent control. Your first sentence is rent control does not work. And the reason we mentioned this is because Oregon recently passed some rent control legislation. So why doesn't rent control work?
Well, it's pretty well established by economists who studied rent control in New York and California and elsewhere, including globally, that rent control, because it puts an artificial squeeze on prices, results in a housing shortage and ultimately escalates the cost of housing. Because it increases the demand for housing because it's cheaper. Now more people are looking for it. And it decreases supply because less people are interested in supplying it because they're not going to be able to make as much of a marginal profit off of it.
That's right. Basically, it doesn't work for the same reason that socialism doesn't work, is because it's artificially controlled. And as you mentioned there, it certainly squelches the supply because so many people will say, what can I do with this money? I don't think I'll put it into building new housing because I can't make any money off of it. So actually, another bleak outcome that you mentioned there in your article is rent control is actually leads to shoddier housing quality because landlords saddled with rent control tend to cut back on maintenance. So, and as you mentioned, too, the notion of rent control is pretty much established fact when it comes to economics, that it just simply doesn't work. So why is it that politicians keep going back to this?
Well, I think it's kind of a classic public choice problem. And in public choice theory says that if the benefits of a policy are really concentrated so that only a few people benefit, but they benefit a great deal, and then the costs are very heavy, but they're sort of dispersed among everyone, then those kinds of policies are often going to get enacted because a small group of people have a really strong and vested interest in getting that to happen, whereas everybody else, you know, they're paying a cost, but it's small per individual. So with rent control, it benefits a small group of established people in the community, and those are the people who are really going to push hard and convince their politicians to move forward. So I think that's why rent control continues to be popular, even though we know from it's pretty straightforward science that it does not actually benefit the community.
No, it doesn't. Also, this from your article, quote, in short, rent control means houses are shabbier, pricier, and harder to find. Yet rent control advocates, rather than face these uncomfortable facts, often resort to blaming landlords or developers for engaging in the exact behavior that economists predicted. So basically, in other words, like any other socialist problem that fails, it's always someone else's fault. But we do want to find solutions. I mean, how do you get to lower housing prices?
Well, I think this is one of those situations where the solution is actually pretty simple, but politically difficult. And the solution is just to build more housing. And so what we need is upzoning. We need municipalities to be more willing to allow things like micro housing, and unfortunately, sort of NIMBYs who oppose that because they're worried about their own property value or they're worried about what it'll do to a neighborhood, just have a lot of power in resisting those kinds of real solutions. And so the natural next step is to turn to these sort of false solutions like rent control.
Well, the other problem with unaffordable housing is it eventually leads to people just simply leaving that market. It gets too expensive to live there. Companies don't stay there because of all of the issues that are entangled with that. But you do mention in your article also some proven methods for housing crisis. And actually, California, surprisingly, has adopted exactly what you said, build more housing.
Yes, the governor's really made a push for this. Ironically, at the same time, there has also been talk in the California legislature and local municipalities about expanding rent control. So it's kind of the governor, I think, sees a solution, and I hope that that the legislatures and city councils in California pay heed to that because they still are kind of in love with the rent control idea. But the idea, the solution is to really encourage local municipalities to build more housing because they face a lot of political pressure not to do that. So the California governor's solution is to sort of hang the funding, the funding sword over their head and say, hey, if you don't meet these housing quotas, we're going to cut your transportation funding or similar sort of incentives. That, I think, does actually make a difference. We'll see. But I think that's the kind of thing that cities need, is they need some incentive.
Well, San Francisco is certainly an example of unaffordable housing. You got people living on the streets there. But it's interesting to read your article and to hear you talk is that the solution is actually the exact opposite of what they espouse. It's a less control, not more control, where you take off the shackles of developers. You let them go out and build. You let them go out and buy land and build the apartments that they need in order to build up the base. Rent control advocates, though, like to point to New York City and Manhattan that both have really high rent control situations, and they say that this is the only way that people can afford to live in the city. But so what happens, though, if a place like New York City or San Francisco or some of these other places tears up and got rid of its rent control regulations? Would prices go up or would they go down?
Well, I think what you'd immediately see is probably a slight increase in rent followed by a pretty precipitous decline, so long as what they also do is liberalize zoning and other policies that would allow for new housing to be constructed. I mean, removing the rent control regime will increase the supply of housing almost immediately. There was an interesting Wall Street Journal article just today about major investment in the housing industry being retarded by rent control growth. So Colorado and some other states are considering something like Oregon's rent control regime. And as a result of that, investment already is scaling back. So just removing those will increase that flow of investment. So you'll see development and growth, I think, pretty quickly. But it should be also done with up zones and other things that actually allow that housing supply to grow.
That's right. Less government is always better government, I think. All right, Dad, let's go and take a break there. We'll talk more with Ethan Blevins. He's an attorney for Pacific Legal Foundation. Their website, pacificlegal.org. Coming up, we'll be talking about the separation of powers. Stay with us. Ethan Blevins, attorney for Pacific Legal Foundation, is our guest today. Their website is pacificlegal.org. They sue the government to achieve court victories to enforce the Constitution's guarantee of individual liberty. His focus is on the First Amendment, property rights, school choice, and the separation of powers. And speaking of that separation of powers, Oregon now has a Democrat supermajority in the legislature and both the House and the Senate. And this means they can stack committees and appointments and all of that that supports their agenda and pretty much pass anything they want, including tax increases that don't need the input of those pesky voters. So when this sort of situation happens, I mean, Oregon's not alone when this sort of supermajority comes into power. Are there steps that people or the minority party can take to try to stop an out-of-control legislature, or do you just have to let it happen?
Oh, no, I think there are many steps that can be taken. You know, most state constitutions have something similar to the federal constitution that separates the branches of government and requires them to essentially play a pose a check or a balance against the other branches. So, I mean, of course, we have courts that enforce constitutional limits. So I think that's always an important and perhaps the clearest way to limit an out of control legislature. Unfortunately, I think we've seen courts become too deferential and they're not playing their role as a check on the legislature, but hopefully robust executive also that wields veto power in a meaningful way. So I think there are a variety of ways, yes, to limit the power of a legislature by ensuring that those other branches of government are active and playing their proper role.
Well, the problem, of course, with Oregon is that we have a radical Democrat governor as well. And so anything that the Democrats want to pass, she is going to be right there signing it. And unfortunately, I think our courts are pretty stacked as well with a lot of Democrats. So we're really in kind of a tough situation. And in fact, I've heard some Republican legislators and senators say that the best solution is to do nothing at all and just let the Democrats burn it all down. Is that ever a viable solution?
Well, no, I don't think that inaction is the proper course. You know, what happens here is the state hits rock bottom, things have gone horribly, and politicians are very good at shifting the blame. So I wouldn't be persuaded that it would be clear to the voters that it's the Democrats' fault that, that things have fallen into disarray.
Yeah, and that's my important. Big issue with that strategy too, is that that might possibly work if you had a media here in the state that was even remotely fair. But they're also Democrats. And so, of course, if it does burn down, they're going to point to the Republicans and say they were the ones holding the matches. So I don't see that this is ever a viable situation. In fact, I have heard one senator from east of the mountains area and in our listening area, Senator Cliff Bentz, who said who was actually speaking to the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, saying, well, look, a carbon tax is it's just here. It's a fact of life now, and we're just going to have to learn to accept it. I'm sorry, I don't buy that argument ever. If you have a chance to fight, you better fight.
Well, yes. And, you know, sometimes it sounds like it's a retreat, but I think one of the beauties of our system of government is that we have a federal system with lots of different states that provide a sort of variety of sort of laboratories for policy experiment. And frankly, one of the best ways we can, as individuals, sort of take advantage of this system of separated powers is to vote with our feet. You know, you don't want to feel like you're abandoning the ship, but frankly, the power to vote with your feet can be one of the few ways that I think citizens can really, really make a difference in their own lives and hopefully influence their own state legislators and say, you know what, we're going to go to a state where it's more business friendly. We're going to go to a state where the tax system isn't going to grind us into dust. And so and that's what we're seeing. I recently saw that Dallas is the city that's growing at the most rapid rate currently in the country. And that's because Texas and that municipality are friendlier to business and so forth. So I think states respond to that to some extent. You know, they want to compete with each other, and that does provide some incentive for them to create an environment where people want to live.
How bad, though, does it have to get? I mean, how many citizens do you have to start bleeding before politicians finally say, you know, maybe what we're doing isn't the best idea?
Well, you know, I think, although it's more on a municipal level, Seattle is an interesting example of this. There was a recent media expose by a local and not particularly conservative news outlet on Seattle that's called Seattle is Dying. And it's essentially about this crazy housing and homelessness crisis in Seattle. And, you know, that's a very progressive city where the progressive constituents have actually started to turn against their own city council. And we'll see what happens. The city council has a few seats open this upcoming election. But I think there is, I think, even among a progressive constituency, a point where they just say things have gone too far. Yeah. And so I think that's starting to happen in Seattle.
Yeah, I saw that documentary. It was really fascinating, actually. And of course, one of the big things in there that they talk about is the fact that the police have not been allowed to enforce the law. So it's an interesting mix. It sounds like, though, that if we have a supermajority here that just goes way too far afield, it sounds like Pacific Legal might actually be an answer to that, because you could maybe help sue them to help rein them back in.
Yes, definitely. I think that public interest litigation, Pacific Legal Foundation, and other groups like us play a really vital role there, because often individuals can't afford to stand up to these kinds of policies on their own because of the costs of litigation and many other factors. So public interest organizations play a really important role there. And And even in unfriendly, what might be seen as unfriendly court systems, there are victories. So in Seattle, we successfully struck down a regulation that required landlords to accept the first applicant who applies for a housing unit, which of course is just wildly insane. And a liberal trial court judge struck that down. So you know, I think that courts can still play a meaningful check.
Yes.
I've been very pleased also to see the federal judicial nominations that we've seen under the current administration. That occurs even in liberal states. So I think that the judiciary is going to, we're going to see a slightly more robust judiciary.
Yes. I absolutely agree. I think the Trump appointments are going to have a huge impact, not only immediately, but for years and even decades to come. I want to thank you so much for your time. His name again, Ethan Blevins. He's with Pacific Legal Foundation, their website, pacificlegal.org. Welcome now, Dr. Bob Zybak. He holds a PhD from OSU in environmental science. His academic focus was in wildfires. In fact, his dissertation was on Indian burning and catastrophic forest fire patterns of the Oregon Coast Range from 1491 to 1951. Bob, it's always great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Good to talk to you as well.
Absolutely. You know, it is absolutely beautiful out as we're talking to you. It's a gorgeous spring day. Woods are damp from winter rains. Air is nice and clean and cool, and trees are getting their leaves out there, and driving out through the countryside, you get to see all of this farm equipment out there in the fields doing their spring planting. So if farmers are preparing their lands, what should foresters be doing this time of year?
Well, something very similar. We had a lot of snow break here in the Cottage Grove area, and so there's a lot of down wood, a lot of it salvageable. Unfortunately, what's on the federal lands and state lands can't be salvaged. They've been mostly shut down from logging, but it's going to pose a fire problem, a ground fire problem, if it's not cleaned up. So they should be preparing the land for planting as well by salvage logging and preparing the sites to grow new forests and to maintain the ones we've got.
You mentioned that the Fed lands, they're not doing anything. And that's really kind of surprising, because I would have thought that Trump would have been able to start correcting some of this by now. Is it just that other things are distracting him, or are there other people within the agency that are still blocking things?
You know, I think it's more that he grew up in New York City, and they don't seem to understand forestry issues. They understand mining issues. They seem to understand ranching issues, but the forestry issues, and particularly those dealing with regulation and that, really have been neglected, and there really is an opportunity to fix that, I think.
Well, what exactly needs to be fixed? Is it simply policies, or is it people, or is it both?
Well, they're both related. The people that make the policies need to be replaced, and the policies have caused degradation, resulted in forest fires, resulting in mass unemployment, resulting in degraded rural communities, passive management of our lands, whether it's wilderness or roadless areas or so-called critical habitat. They've been able to effectively shut down active management on our federal and state lands the last 30 years, and that's created the serious problems we're seeing in Northern California and Western Oregon and Eastern Washington these past few years.
Well, I know that Trump is making some changes within the sage-grouse rules, and I think we're going to be asking about that a little bit later. But as far as the remaining time that we have in this segment here, I'd like to ask you something that's going to become apparent in the next segment, actually. Are colleges on top of the game when it comes to curriculum to help prepare young foresters?
I don't think so. I think there's been a vast misdirection the last two or three decades towards modeling, computerized game playing, basically, and calling it science. I think science is being degraded through the process, but certainly our forests and rural communities are being degraded.
Well, what exactly is the content? I was just going to say, so what exactly is the content of some of the state forestry curriculum? Because as you mentioned, it sounds more like they're doing all of this modeling and whatnot. I mean, that's statistics. Statistics is math. It's not science.
That's right. And statistics just aren't powerful enough to replicate ecology or biology or however you want to look at it across the landscape on that basis. So they come up with information, and maybe it's accurate information, but they extrapolate it to the wrong scale. And the worst thing is they're not out in the woods studying what's actually going on. They're not getting experience working in the woods like earlier generations of students did. And so it's all digital. It's all what is habitat condition. They take snapshots in time and then they extrapolate that. And nature doesn't work that way.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because that was going to be my next question. Is it possible to graduate with a degree in forestry but never actually get into the forest?
When I was going to Oregon State, it was kind of sad. They've got a research forest, and for several years, students weren't even using the research forest. In the past, say in the 50s and 60s and 70s, a lot of forestry students would work in the woods during the summer, or they would work at the OSU Research Forest, so they would get that experience. But in the late 80s and early 90s, that was almost totally eliminated. So you can go to school now, get a forestry degree, and basically have no experience, very little knowledge, but be real good at meeting the public or presenting something or theorizing about something or making computer printouts. And you really don't need the experience or the actual knowledge of forestry in order to be get a degree, even an advanced degree. And I think that's a problem. There's an indoctrination process in which students are taught values of, say, critical habitat as opposed to economic values of forest management.
It sounds like they're more prepared to grow government than they are prepared to grow trees. All right, let's go take a break there. Coming back, we want to talk to him about the Elliott Forest Management and the plans that are happening there. If you'll remember, this is an issue from previous shows. Elliott Forest is supposed to be money generator for the state. Is it? And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Dr. Bob Zybak. He holds a PhD from OSU in environmental sciences. His academic focus was in wildfires, and he's really our longtime consultant here on the iSpy Radio Show for forestry and logging. And speaking of forests, the Elliott Forest has been an issue here for a number of years. This is a state forest that is supposed to be generating money for the state. It's supposed to be creating money for our schools, which never seem to have enough. But of course, state management has been basically ignoring it. It's been letting it sit there and rot and in some cases burn. And so you've been very invested in trying to correct bad management issues on that forest. So how are things going?
Well, it's they're up in the air. The forest continues to lose money, I would say, because of mismanagement and the political process rather than any practical reason. So that part's kind of sad. They didn't sell it. I think the last time we were talking, the state was trying to sell it and get rid of their obligation as far as managing the land specifically for the Common School Fund. It should be generating $20 or $25 million a year for our schools, and instead it's costing a few million dollars a year for lawyers.
Well, it is ugly that this is something that should be generating revenue and it's just costing us money. So after years of trying to figure out what to do with the Elliott Forest, how about logging it, Oregon lawmakers suddenly think they may have a plan which doesn't involve logging it. And this is from the OPB article, Oregon Moves On Plan to Repurpose the Elliott State Forest for Research. And this from the article, members of the state board voted Tuesday to start work on a plan to transfer the 80,000-acre forest near Coos Bay to Oregon State University. So how is that legal? I mean, this is a forest that's supposed to be generating income for the state, and now we're transferring ownership to a university, the university, of course, which costs the state money, and it's all to research a forest, again, that is supposed to be generating money rather than, which we could be doing if we were logging it. But instead, they just want to study it, I guess. So how is that legal?
I have no idea on the legality. It's a boondoggle. It's mismanagement. It's been going on for several years now, 4 or 5 years in particular, but 25 years overall. And the news that they're trying to transfer ownership to Oregon State is new. We talked with the president, President Ray of Oregon State, Wayne Giese, and I in January, and he was very concerned about that, that the state wanted the $100 million more dollars that they didn't have, Oregon State didn't have, and he didn't want to be obligated to owing that money. So the plan, that the last I heard at the meetings, public meetings, that were apparently decisions made prior to the meetings that they implemented, was that Oregon State is going to come up with a plan to conduct research on the Elliott and present that plan to the state in December. So they're just starting out on that process now. They have an advisory council at Oregon State University, and they have a separate one, State Land Board, that are gathering information so they can put together the plan. But I know the state would like to transfer ownership to the university, but I'm not sure. I haven't heard anything that they've actually made that decision, or that Oregon State's accepted that. It's just in the planning process was the latest I heard.
So according to the article, the plan would include a mix of uses on the forestry on the forest, including active management, whatever they mean by that. Other uses would reflect public values identified by the land board, like recreation, public access, and conservation, all of which sounds like it's going to cost money rather than generate money. But there are elements of that plan that I recall from past discussions with you being part of the Giese plan that you had talked about. So did they basically steal some of this from you? Or, I mean, did they co-opt some of this? What do you think?
I hope they didn't steal it, but yes, we had a plan on board, on the table, for about 2 years, specifically requested by the governor and the state land board in public meetings and in private meetings, to, actively manage the research forest. And I think I'm one of the first people to use that term active management, from about 25 years ago when we were discussing the Elliott and marbled murrelets at that time. So active management involves maintaining the roads, logging, providing habitat, recreational opportunities. In other words, not letting the forest, abandoning the forest and letting them burn up, as what's been happening the last 3 decades.
Well, in terms of active management, do you think that they mean the same thing when you say active management? Does it mean actually logging?
You know, I think they do. I think they're using it as a code word now because they're saying they don't want to actively manage the whole forest. They only want to actively manage portions of it. So I think they're using it as a euphemism for logging because that's an unpopular term these days.
Well, yeah, we wouldn't actually want to use the term logging. I mean, heaven forbid we actually do that in our forest.
or worse, clear cutting.
yeah. Well, anyway, it'll be interesting to watch as this plan unfold because, you know, I know that we have talked so many times is that here in Oregon, it's almost hard to stop trees from growing back. And I know that when we have talked to people like from people in like Wyoming and some of these other areas where North Dakota is another good one, where they're actually doing mining and mineral research and stuff, they are just aghast that here Oregon has this completely renewable source of income that we simply ignore versus what they have, which is, you know, pots of oil in the ground. Eventually, those are going to run out. The trees just keep right on growing back. I mean, it is literally money growing on trees.
Well, it's money if you harvest them, if you actively manage them. But if you abandon them, they turn into fuel.
That's right.
And that's what's been happening. So
that's right.
They've turned into a cost for wildfire fighting and for the lost communities such as Paradise, California, human loss of life, human loss of millions of wildlife. The wildlife they're supposedly providing habitat for are getting fried. Their habitat is being dramatically changed within hours and days. So what they're saying they're trying to achieve and the results we're getting, they call them unintended consequences, but people such as myself have been telling them for 25 years, you can't do that.
Yeah,
it's not a matter of the trees going back there in Western Oregon, the invasive, the Willamette Valley, if you look around there where most of the people live, all those trees have migrated into the valley or been planted in the valley in the last 200 years. Mm. It used to be virtually a free of trees, and certainly the forested areas, you can't keep the trees from growing.
Yeah, and it's amazing how our perceptions change. Now they think that's the norm, but like you say, it was pretty much devoid of forests as well. Everyone, let's go and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more Dr. Bob Zybak coming up. We'll be talking about what we can expect this summer for the forest fire. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Dr. Bob Zybak. He holds a PhD from OSU in environmental science. His focus is on wildfires. And Bob, we were talking during the break there, and that OPB article is actually somewhat irrelevant in the sense that since that article was published, there was actually a memorandum of understanding with the OSU that you said was in 2019. So why don't you give us some updates on that?
Okay. Yeah, I think the article was an error. They wanted to sell it to Oregon State, but Oregon State doesn't have the funding to buy it, and the president made that very clear. The memorandum of understanding was signed in early February between Oregon State and the state land board, which manages the Common School Fund lands, and it stated that they were to produce a research plan by December of this year. That the plan can be, the understanding can be broken by either party with no financial consequence, no need to even rationalize it. And all the funding aspects are side issues. They're not in the memorandum of understanding. But there's been no agreement by Oregon State to buy the land, nor has the state transferred ownership to Oregon State. I think that's one of the options on the table. But that's not the situation at this point.
So it doesn't sound like, basically, as far as the state is concerned about transferring that to Oregon State, it doesn't sound like that's going anywhere.
I hope not, but they could still be planning on it because they really haven't been too forthcoming with what it is they're doing.
Well, just because it's a bad idea and just because it's expensive doesn't mean the government won't want it. So we need to keep an eye on this for sure.
I think that's the problem, is the government has proved itself incapable, the current government and maybe the last two or three elected governments here in Oregon have proven themselves incapable of effectively managing the forest, which has been done.
It's not even just forest, it's finances. I mean, again, we're back to the situation that this state forest should be generating millions of dollars for the state and for schools, but instead it's costing the state millions of dollars.
Needed in rural areas.
Exactly. But any kind of income or actual revenue generation that would mean work and not just simply taxing people that are working, they don't seem to want to do it. And it's such an easy solution.
Well, they either don't want to do it, or they're incapable of doing it. It is an easy solution. We just had a major mill shut down in Coos Bay, and another one that's been going since 1951 in Glendale and Douglas County. So Douglas and Coos County are sitting there with a wealth of timber, potential wealth, that's turning into fuel for a wildfire. It's a mismanagement situation, and whether they're doing it on purpose to achieve some kind of objective or they're just incompetent, either way, it's costing thousands of rural jobs where they're most needed, Coos and Douglas County,
and
mills are shutting down for a lack of timber, and it's ridiculous.
Right, which means that they're not only missing out on the opportunity to sell these logs, but then they're also missing out on the additional tax revenue that would happen by people having jobs. And it's a double whammy. And the schools are costing that much more. We've only got a couple of minutes here.
And they're increasing wildfire risk, and that's increasing risk to the wildlife population they say they're trying to protect. So the rationale for what they're doing doesn't hold water. There's no historical precedent for it.
Well, exactly right. Plus, you know, as we discussed, they were potentially working with a school that isn't even training force on how to work the force anyway. So you mentioned wildfires, and this is, of course, a big thing here. In the last couple of years, these out-of-control forest fires have cost us something in the neighborhood north of $500 million. And we've only got a couple minutes here with you, but real quick, what is coming out of the Capitol? As far as the upcoming forest fire season, do you get any sense that people are starting to move towards better forest management?
Unfortunately, not much sense of that at all. They're just creating firebombs out there, and these were protected 20 and 25 years ago. If they passively managed the land, it would burn up, and that's exactly what's been happening. So there have been calls for active management of California forests, and I think they're doing something in Montana, but we have to be salvaging those fuels, such as in Southwest Oregon, where they've had four major fires come out of the Calmeopsis Wilderness since 1987. And hopefully they're going to start seeing the wisdom in that.
Well, we can hope. There doesn't, you know, government bureaucrats and government itself seems to be a bit of a lost cause here. But do you get any sense that there's a change for the better with people and the voters, that they want more logging and management?
I think the problem is ignorance. I think people aren't getting any forestry education. They don't understand the issues. And that includes the people in charge of managing our forests these days. And so, no, I'm not getting any sense of that, because people, they don't even know what the Common School Fund is when you talk to them, much less any aspects related to active forest management and the values of doing that.
Well, that's definitely unfortunate. Dr. Bob Zybak, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Us too. I do hope the voters are starting to wake up. But it doesn't help that the rest of the media here in Oregon ignores basic facts. Simple things like how Oregon went some 50 years without a single major forest fire because they were practicing active, real forest management. And yes, that included harvesting trees. Funny how the left is suddenly banning plastic bags, because all those bags are ending up in the ocean and whales are choking on them. Funny how you never heard about whales choking on paper bags. You remember those? They were made out of trees that we used to cut, that used to fund our roads and our schools. It amazes me how so much of the green movement involves not doing something rather than doing something, like active forest management. Doing nothing is not management. The next time you help decide who leads the government, keep that in mind. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.